This is case 38 from the Shoyoroku. Linji's true person. Introduction. Taking a thief for one's son. Taking the servant for the master. Can a broken wooden ladle be your ancestor's skull? A donkey saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. When breaking earth, separating reeds, how do you discern the master? Main case. Linji said to the assembly, there is a true person of no rank, always going out and in through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look, look. Then a monk came forward and said, what is the true person of no rank? Linji got down from his seat, grabbed him and said, speak, speak. The monk hesitated. So Linji pushed him away and said, the true person of no rank, what a piece of dry crap he is. The verse. Delusion and enlightenment are opposite. Subtly communicated with simplicity, spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Power pulls back 9 bulls in one yank. It's hopeless. The mud and sand cannot be cleared away. Clearly blocking off the eye of the sweet spring. If suddenly it bursts forth, it would freely flow. So I want to begin by thanking you all for being here. Usually we end with that, especially with the daylight saving, losing an hour. It takes effort and effort to show up. Always, right? Wherever we go, there is some effort involved. Right? And to show up to a place that is asking us to sit down, to stay still and silent for hours, and to examine, to take a look at what we often run away from. It takes a very different kind of effort. So I have deep, deep gratitude for all of you for showing up. So today at the end of the Zazenkai, we begin a 3-month journey of Ango with a commitment to use this training period for working with the matter of humility as the theme of the Ango. Now, the word humility, like any other word we hear, raises many kinds of personal interpretations which tend to grab our attention and create a sense of knowing. Or at least a sense of having some idea of what it means. And yet, while it is natural to have a personal idea or ideas and feelings in relation to what we hear, it is often just an elaborate mental construct that's created from bits and pieces of our past personal experiences as they interact with the experience of this moment. It is an automatic process that actually fits very well with the need to examine humility in our lives. Because it comes out of and it creates what we may call non-humility. The constant formation of mental constructs infiltrates all aspects of our lives. and it becomes like a shadow companion that gives us an unspoken description of our identity. And whatever our senses happen to interact with is immediately interpreted by this shadow companion and propels it like a hamster wheel, always affirming the grand story of self while hardening the shell of what separates us from the world. So as we mentioned in the Anga overview last Sunday, like Buddhahood, humility is a natural state of being. So there's nothing special about it. And in the same way that we do not become enlightened, we also do not become humble. The focus is here on the creation of an unenlightened way of being, or unhumble way of being, which in terms of our theme means instead of getting busy trying to act in humble ways, we direct our attention to how we act in non-humble ways, or how we nurture non-humility through our words and our actions that sustain the idea of a non-changing self. There's a deeply intimate connection between the formation of a defined self to the perpetuation of self-centered actions and reactions, which we need to recognize on a personal level. As long as we remain unaware of it, our habitual reactivities to life will feel justifiable, and our actions will continue to be in the service of an egoic, unhumble entity. That's not in question. That's the habit. In the chapter about self-absorption, Trogam Trungpa says, we are fascinated with maintaining familiar surroundings, familiar desires and longings, so as not to give in to a spacious state of mind. We cling to our habitual patterns because confusion provides us a tremendously familiar ground to sink into, as well as a way of occupying ourselves. We're afraid to give up on this security and entertainment, afraid to step into open space, into a meditative state of mind. The prospect of the awakened state is very irritating because we are uncertain how to handle it. So we prefer to run back to our prison rather than release ourselves from it. Confusion and suffering become an occupation, often quite secure and delightful. Even when we suffer, still it can be delightful in terms of the security that it provides. Not that it's going to feel good. It's the clinging that we have to examine. So being self-absorbed is one of the most prevalent habits for us as human beings. So first we need to acknowledge that the practice is asking us to take on a radical endeavor that may feel threatening and often counterintuitive. I remember when I started to get deeper and deeper into practice, there was a period that felt like I am actually taking a sledgehammer and breaking the walls of my house. That was the feeling. And there was a part of me that said, what the hell are you doing? Are you out of your mind? It was scary. It is scary. Scary to a point of wanting to go back to something else, wanting to get away from this, wanting to stop practicing, because we think it's the practice that has anything to do with that. So we think if I stop practicing, then I'm good. There was definitely a great deal of resistance, which is quite common as the practice deepens for everyone and it begins to penetrate that sense of security. I'm not sure if there's a way to bypass meeting this kind of resistance or the resistance of our hardened identity. It is a natural form of self-defense mechanism that is triggered by mistake due to a strong belief in a false identity. In other words, the reactivity is actually very natural. What triggers it is the false. On the way to discovering our inherent self, we need to face and gradually disengage from our own personal creation of it, or first realize that we are creating it. And we need to learn to recognize it as false. Now, to recognize something as false doesn't mean to read about it or hear about it. It means to feel in our own gut that something's off. Something is not working or not working well. So this is an issue, the issue that is raised by the introduction to this koan. It says, taking the thief for one's son, taking the servant for the master, realizing what we're doing. And then it is asking us, can a broken wooden ladle be your ancestor's skull? It looks like that, may look like that, maybe from afar, right? But when you start to get deep into it, you begin to recognize, wait a minute, this is not real. This is not what I think it is. I am not what I think I am. And then it says, a donkey's saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. We think it is. Any identification we form is essentially taking the servant for the master, or mistakenly assuming the false as the truth. It could be an identification with a group of people, a nation, job title, appearance, achievements, opinions, grudge, skin color, gender, habits, or anything else that begins with the declaration, I am. I am that. I am with these people. I am like those people. So any declaration that begins with I am quickly becomes interlaced with our personal story and our self-definition. Even being a Zen practitioner, even that. While the path of Zen may be a skillful tradition, there is no fixed entity we can call a Zen practitioner. There's no such thing. We're not, and we're not becoming Zen practitioners. There's nothing beyond the provisional aspect of such a term, which we use provisionally. So to expose this error, we need to shake things up and cultivate the ability for sharp discernment through observing our thoughts, our speech, our actions, not to take it for granted. And so the last line of the introduction says, when breaking earth, separating reeds, how do you discern the master? And breaking earth, separating reeds is the job description for each Anga period. This is what we're doing. We are purposefully shaking things up, turning all the lights, looking at every corner, looking, and admitting. So in this koan, Linji said to the assembly, "There is a true person of no rank, always going out and in through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look. The portals of your face, your nose, your mouth, your ears, facial expressions too, all of it, right? Your sweat. There is truth freely coming in and out, freely expressing itself." And he's saying, if you have not witnessed it yet, take a look. Now, Linji, also known as Rinzai in Japanese, as most of you know, is the founder of the Rinzai School of Zen, which, along with the Soto School, are the only two that still exist out of the original five Zen sects. So we are a Soto lineage that has a strong Rinzai influence. So what does that make us? On paper, it's a Soto. Maybe when you look at what we do, it's difficult to discern. Sometimes it looks like Soto, sometimes a little bit like Rinzai. Who are we? So in a commentary by Shishin on this koan, Shishin is one of Maizumi's successor, he says, "Maizumi Roshi was empowered by teachers in both Rinzai and the Soto school. So we could say that we belong to the Rinzai school. If we say so, then it becomes a rank. Really, we are Soto, but we're not that either. It's just a practice, pure, clear practice with no basis on which to depend. A fellow teacher once asked me if I belong to the Rinzai or the Soto school. I answered that I belong to the half-breed school. I'm a mutt. I'm both Soto and Rinzai. But even this is not true," he says. Even it is not true. Being a mutt is actually very helpful when it comes to releasing identification. And I find it quite fitting. I ended up in such a Zen lineage. So it goes along with my personal heritage. My father was half Turkish, half Romanian. My mother half Yemenite and half Moroccan. So luckily, no pure blood can be found here. I don't know. Bits and pieces of all kinds of influences. That's what we're left with. But even that is not answering the question, who are you? Even when you figure it out, or you do the analysis of all the influences that you have in your blood, still there is the question, who are you? So what is a true person of no rank? Or we can ask, what is a person of rank? So much of our life is saturated with divisions, grades, ranks, to a point of barely being able to see ourselves and each other without some degree of categorizing or measuring. And it's as if we all walk around with an imaginary ruler, always measuring ourselves and others using standards and parameters we inherited through personal and societal karma. And somehow, it always seems to be what we think and feel about ourselves. Somehow it all fits together and creates something that feels very solid, seems very solid. But what does that mean about me? Am I good? Am I bad? Am I included? Am I rejected? What is my value today? That's what it creates, a continuous questioning. It might give us an answer for 5 minutes or a week. Then the answer expires because there's a new one. So what does that mean about us? And this constant preoccupation with someone who does not exist beyond thought, yet the need or habit to attach external value to ourselves and to each other has been deeply interlaced in human lives since ancient times. It's a constant occupation with that which does not exist if we're not constantly occupied with it. In other words, it's the preoccupation with it that maintains and sustains it. And it's always been this way. It doesn't make it true, but it definitely makes it something we can all share as we examine that. It's one of the many things that unite us. There's a story about Linji, who was once invited to some important banquet with the emperor. So he came in with his ragged robes, the day-to-day robes, not the ceremonial robes. So he came in and he tried to get through the gate, but they looked at him and they said, no, you're not welcome here. This is for special people, right? Only with special invitation. You don't look like one of those guys. So he went back. He went back to the monastery. He put on his ceremonial purple robe and came back. Of course, they let him in. Oh, yeah, please. So he went in. They showed him to his chair. He went to the chair. He took off his robe. He put it on the chair and started leaving. And they asked him, where are you going? He said, you did not invite me, you invited my robe. So here it is. You did not invite me. This is a good story that is showing us how we often see each other or see ourselves. What do we see when we look at another? If at the moment of looking at another, we're able to stay with the looking, to truly stay with the looking, we will be able to see a true person of no rank. If we can avoid the temptation to go along with the immediate interpretation that shows up as soon as we see something, as soon as we hear something, if only we can avoid the temptation, then we will see. It's a radical kind of seeing, not what we're used to. This koan also appears in another collection, The True Dharma Eye. And in the commentary, it says, the true person of no rank is the real form of truth as it appears throughout the universe. It is fluid, in a constant state of becoming. The true person of no rank is the real form of truth as it appears throughout the universe. It, too, is fluid and in a constant state of becoming. Rank or no rank are non-dual. Therefore, each and everything, up to and including each one of us, exists thus. The essence of all phenomena is thusness. The real nature of body and mind is thusness. Therefore, it cannot be attained by any personal effort, realized or not. It has always been manifesting as our very life itself. Realize it or not, it is thus. This is why we can create, we can become. This is why the work is never on attaining as much as examining what we do to create the illusion that we're not. To create the illusion that we're not a Buddha, and then to trust that illusion. And equating the notion of a true person with the action of a fluid state of becoming is fundamental to natural expression of authenticity. Again, true person, equating that with the action of a fluid state of becoming, is or leading to a natural expression of authenticity. Not the kind of authenticity I would like to have or attain or become. It's the kind of authenticity that has no opposite. Not the kind that can be measured. And it is so, since the person is acting in ways that align with the original self. That's what makes it authentic. And being aligned with the original self, there is nothing to gain and nothing to lose. Nothing to gain, nothing to lose. Now, on the other hand, being aligned with our personal story or trying to stay true to who we think we are cannot lead to authentic living and only further self-centeredness. And so we need to recognize the connection between authenticity and humility. And we also need to recognize the essence of our being and the expression of our senses. The essence of our being and the expression of our senses. Otherwise, they remain in the service of our egoic self. Well, in other words, when being aligned, there is nothing but authenticity. And when being aligned with everything as one, who can be unhumble? What gives birth to non-humility? Linji said at some other time, followers of the way, mind is without form and pervades the 10 directions. In the eye, it's called seeing. In the ear, it's called hearing. In the nose, it smells odors. In the mouth, it holds conversations. In the hand, it grasps and seizes. In the feet, it runs and carries. Fundamentally, it is one pure radiance. Divided, it becomes harmoniously united spheres of senses. Since the mind is not existence, wherever you go, you're free. And one ancient asked, and so what is it in the eyebrows? What is it in the eyebrows? Is it different? When we realize that the true person of no rank, or the truth, freely comes and goes through all our actions, all our interactions, then where is it lacking? Where is it lacking? Or where does the idea of lack come from? Originally, all things are united. You can adjust position if needed. And about the six senses, Linji also said, the six rays never cease to emit the great light. The six rays never cease to emit the great light. So in a way, we are going to that which is trapping us, seemingly trapping us, right, our senses, and we are realizing that it is also constantly emitting the truth. So what we use to trap ourselves can also be used to free ourselves. The same senses, the same mind, the same person. So after hearing there is a true person of no rank always going out and in through the portals of your face, a monk came forward and said, what is the true person of no rank? Linji got down from his seat, grabbed him and said, speak, speak. Now here is an opportunity. Here is an opportunity to be authentic or to express authenticity. Speak. But I don't know what to say. I'm confused. I don't know what you expect me to say. I don't know how will I sound. What will they think of me? Will I be approved or rejected? I don't know. That's already too late. If we go to the mind to ask what to say, it's too late. But if we just express, then, who is it that's expressing? So speak, speak. The monk hesitated. And the footnote says, he bogs down the true person. Who? Linji or the monk? What happens when we hesitate? We bog down the true person. Not trusting ourselves. So Linji pushed him away and said, the true person of no rank, what a piece of dry crap he is. Now if this sounds harsh or unkind, it is only due to our emotional interpretations. It's not what you think it is. Linji was not rebuking or degrading this monk, nor was he mocking him in any way. He was simply being truthful by saying that the true person of no rank is mirror to us at all times, through each and every manifestation of life. It's not dividing or divided. There is no sacred and mundane. There is no good or bad, important, unimportant. There is, if we go to our picking and choosing, obviously, a lot of it. But putting aside picking and choosing, again, the true person of no rank manifests freely. When Master Umon was asked by a monk, what is Buddha? He answered, Kenchi Katsu, dried up shit stick. A dried up shit stick. you may not know, but back in those days, they didn't have toilet paper, so they used sticks. And they left them to dry out. So there was a lot of it laying around everywhere. What is Buddha? A dried up shit stick. Now, in the mind that divides and put things in categories and ranks, where will a dried up shit stick end? Where will it be found? You won't even be noticed. That's not the kind of stuff we look for. Thing is, when we divide. Period. And the more we divide, the better we get at it. The more we trust it, the more we believe it. So these ancient teachers did not waste time on trying to be nice or beat around the bush. Their single-minded task has always been to expose our attachment to false conceptions so we can awaken to a unified self. Also, through the struggles of their own spiritual journeys, they realized how pathetic and foolish we are as human beings, creating our own suffering by grasping the illusion of a conceptual self while turning away from the real one. And it's only by exposing the falsehood that the real can come forth and naturally manifest as compassionate and selfless actions. Only by exposing the false. You remember that story? Somebody came to the Buddha and asked him, "I am a dedicated practitioner. I'm doing everything. I do all the stuff, right? I sit regularly. I chant. I follow the scriptures. Why do I still feel this way? Why do I still feel stuck?" And the Buddha said, "Because you still trust it. Because you still trust it. It's not going through the motions that's going to free us. It's actually looking at where it hurts. Only through looking to at where it hurts, stuck, unpleasant, only then we can realize where we put our trust and then shift it, naturally shift it." Dogen said, "Fools think that they are someone else. The wise see themselves in everyone. A fool is somebody who creates himself or herself, or walks around with an image. That would be a fool in this sense. And the wise see themselves in everyone. The wise realizes that they do not exist unto themselves. Do not exist unto themselves." So this is Dogen, and this same message also is echoed in one of Einstein's most profound sayings, which you've heard a few times. Einstein: "A human being experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness." And then he said, "This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty." This is the whole point. of a Zazenkai, a Sishin, Ango. This is what we're doing. Widening our circle of compassion. Or we can say realizing how wide and vast we are already. So then we can embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. And this is the true source of humility. Because if we don't experience ourselves in others, seeing another as a mirror to who we are, if this doesn't happen, then how are we going to act in humble ways? We're not. We're not. We will remain self-centered. As long as there is a self, fixed self, there is self-centeredness. It's just the way it is. There's no other way to get to humility. There's no my version of humility. Sounds good. Does not exist. In our daily life, there are countless examples of how the illusory self manifests and how we get triggered and react, retaliate, and defend it tooth and nail. Whether implicitly or explicitly, we often take things personally and operate under the assumption that situations or other people are either against us or for us. We may not like to admit this, but we tend to view ourselves as the center of the universe. We go back again and again to picking and choosing. And we can ask, how can we not, right? It's absolutely supernatural to do that. I'll take care of myself first, then you. And it makes sense. It makes sense as long as I don't see me in you. Fools think there's someone else. As long as I'm a fool, that's how I'm going to act. Not only that, naturally, I will act this way. But if I see me in you, then taking care of you is taking care of me. And so we need to open up to the possibility that it seems this way only because we hold on to a rigid and defined self-identity. Many situations we perceive something as a threat and take it personally, mostly due to our perception, low self-esteem, or having some kind of a distorted image of ourselves, which is also a version of self-centeredness. And then what about times we encounter some obnoxious energy that is clearly directed at us, right? We can say, well, this is an unmistaken example of something being directed at me. So should I not take it personally? So can we deal with such a forceful expression, obnoxious, forceful expression, in a conducive way without taking it personally? And the answer to that depends on the density of our selfhood. As long as there is a self, fixed, dense, then yeah, I'm okay with not taking things personally until they are clearly personal. That's it. That's my limit. From that point on, I'm going to take it personally, and I will retaliate. So what's the level of density of our falsehood, of our selfhood? Falsehood, selfhood. Is it solid like a piece of rock, or is it flowing like water? And our Zazen practice can be a very effective way to shift from the solid to the flowing, to expand from the small sphere of our illusory self to the large sphere of being, a being that embraces all living creatures, as Einstein said. And the thing is, by remaining still and intimately observing how the conceptual self is formed through thoughts, emotions, memories, and residual karmic energies, only through that we can recognize that it is empty of solid matter that can be called me. So when we are not looking at that, it's easy to call it me. I am that. This is who I am. But when we look at it, look deeper and deeper, we start to realize, wait a minute, this is pixelating. This is not what it seems. I am not what I seem. Then we can experience the true person of no rank, as the Buddha who is sitting on this cushion, wearing these clothes, eating this food, and living this unique, precious life. So in commenting on this, Dogen actually criticized Linji, saying that he only knows about the true person of no rank, but does not know about the true person of rank. And in a way, this is Dogen's way of saying that our task is to actualize the fundamental point in the midst of our everyday existence. It's going to work, raising a family, paying the bills, and living within a society that is structured based on ranks and divisions. It's one of the most common questions, right? When I go to sit with a Sangha, I feel great. I feel even, things are equalized. I feel supported. Then I go to work. Then I have to deal with all these people that know nothing about practice and are deeply attached to ranks and divisions. What do I do then? The thing is, yes, of course we have ranks. Of course we use this kind of language and hierarchies. But when you realize the true person of no rank, you are free to hold any position without ever identifying with it. And it won't tarnish anything. It won't interfere with humility, because you experience the true person of no rank. Then the true person of rank can appear, because they're not two. So you can remain empty. You can remain empty while occupying the form. Imagine the freedom of functioning like this. There's a story about two boats colliding, two versions of that. In one version, there's a person in each boat, and two boats collide, and then the person on one boat is yelling at the person in the other boat, "Did you not see me? I was here. How could you be so blind?" Right? Now, in the second version of this story, there's a person only in one boat. The other boat, there's nobody there. And the other person, instead of yelling, just takes care of what's happened, the damage. Because there's nobody to yell at. Because the boat is empty. Imagine living like that. As long as we walk around with a self, there will be somebody who will have a problem with that. Many somebodies. But what if we walk around without it? Empty of self. It's not a novelty, it's what we are anyway. That's why he said in the commentary, realize or not, this is not the truth. This is not happening, although we are convinced it is. Fine, keep going. But then stop and take a look and realize, and then empty out, release. Then what happens? So, Linji, bring to rest the thoughts of the ceasingly seeking mind, and you will not differ from the Buddha. Do you want to know the Buddha? He is none other than the one who sits before me listening to this talk. When you lack faith in yourself, you run around seeking something outside. Even if, through your seeking, you did find something, that something would be nothing more than fancy descriptions in written words. You will not gain the mind of a living Buddha. Make no mistake, worthy Zen practitioners, if you don't find it here and now, you will never find it anywhere. And I brought this up a couple of sessions ago at Sesshin. And this was not referring to the monastery. Because it's always the case, if you don't find it here and now, you will never find it anywhere. So the last line of the verse says, if suddenly it bursts forth, it would freely flow. If suddenly it bursts forth, it would freely flow. And then Hongzhi added another line, another word to that, dangerous. Dangerous. Why is it dangerous? The practice and realization are the greatest threat to our egoic self, which is why there is so much resistance and fear. So in the next 3 months, we will turn towards this threat, willingly turn towards this threat, by becoming aware of how often our thoughts, words, and actions originate from self-concern. And we will ask, how am I meeting this moment? Do I encounter this personal situation from an inner sense of lack or from an inner sense of completion? How often do I take things personally? Do I need to seek approval from others? Or can I take on the responsibility to be the one who verifies my own being through open and continuous observation? And what happens when I take on this responsibility, when I stop demanding from the world to give me some validation? Completely stop demanding from the world to give you what the world cannot give you. Then what? How do I listen to others? That's a very important point. Patience. We often talk about patience. So how do I listen to others? How much me is there while I'm listening to others? Or in other words, how much am I listening to myself when I pretend to be listening to another? Because that's what it becomes. It just becomes pretending to. Or waiting for my turn to speak while I'm listening. How often do I interject instead of listening patiently? Can I fully give myself to what I do and find contentment in activity? And find contentment whether or not others acknowledge my work or even acknowledge my existence. And we have to ask, when somebody is acknowledging and says, That's a great job. Wow, incredible. We have to stop and ask, what did I just gain? Not just bask in some idea of gaining something, because that's the automatic. We have to stop and, what did I just gain? Did I gain anything? Or if somebody either does not acknowledge or thumbs down, this was very poor performance. What have I lost? Instead of reacting, to pause and take a look. And one last point. Joshu once asked his followers, can you value this without reservations? I think this is a profound question to take, to go with us for life. For life. Hopefully until the last breath on this earth, we can ask that question. Can you value this without reservations? It'll do two things. First of all, it will expose you to you all the reservations that you have, and it'll show you how you get stuck. It'll show you the culprit of your contentment or discontentment, right? It'll show you what's in the way. And then at the same time, it'll show you that, or show us, that when we do value without reservations, then naturally the truth manifests. Right then and there. It's another way to ask if I can put down all the picking and choosing. Put it down and value this without reservation. We may not like it, but with the dislike, can I still value this without reservations? So, just one thing I would ask us all to do in the next 3 months is to work on maintaining continuity of exposure to the Dharma, to the teachings, to each other, to the Sangha. Wherever you are, whatever is going on in your life, don't make it a hindrance. Make it an ingredient for your awakening. Thank you.